Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Delighted to be with you today. Extra delighted. Jimmy Akin is here with us both hours. So you are welcome to call with your questions. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884. If you were looking at your schedule and it says Carlo Broussard, then you can blame the snow. And the weather has changed things around for us. So Jimmy here with us. Maybe we'll get Carlo on later in the week. But in any case, we'll do Ask Me Anything. And you're welcome to ask whatever you'd like. 888-318-7884. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He is the guy who makes Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin podcast, the author of a whole bunch of books, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, The Bible is a Catholic Book, all kinds of things. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. I guess you are about to get your own snow there in Arkansas, huh?
Oh, no, we're not about to. We're getting it right now.
Oh, it's coming down.
Coming down quite hard, and we're supposed to get 7 or 8 inches, and it's supposed to get down to 15 below, so it's quite chilly here. And if that's the case here in northwest Arkansas, I would assume the same thing is the case over in Oklahoma where Carlo is.
Yeah, and it didn't mess with your commute today? No problems with the commute in?
No, I stumbled out of my bedroom and made it here to my home office just fine.
Okay, very good. Very good. Again, 888-318-7884. You can ask whatever you like to Jimmy Akin. And we really mean whatever you like when Jimmy is on. 888-31-TRUTH. It's Tuesday. A new episode dropped yesterday of the Jimmy Akin podcast.
You got it.
Yeah. I finally got it.
I begin and end the week with podcasts. Yes. Yeah. So yesterday on the Jimmy Akin podcast, it was on a controversial question that shouldn't be controversial, but it is. Do Muslims worship God? And in this, I quote from a pope, one of the great reforming popes of the Middle Ages, who answers that question for us, and I show you what he had to say on it. And if you're one of those folks who say, oh, Muslims and Christians just worship different gods, what has been part of Catholic tradition for a very long time will surprise you.
That was
the Jimmy Akin podcast. I also had a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on Friday, and that was on the Immaculate Constellation Unacknowledged Special Access Program that Congress has reportedly not been properly briefed on and that deals with UFOs. Coming up this Friday on Mysterious World, I'm going to have the first of a two-part look at the history of the USS Hornet, which was an aircraft carrier in World War II and subsequently. And there are some very interesting mysteries connected with the USS Hornet.
All right. You can check them both out wherever you get your podcasts, the Jimmy Akin podcast and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You can check them out on YouTube. Or you go to mysterious.fm for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hundreds of episodes over there. All righty, the phones lines are filling up. I'll tell you what, there's one line open. And so you are welcome to fill that one if you've got a question for Jimmy. 888-318-7884. We'll start in Florida today. Eduardo is in Florida. Hello, Eduardo. You got a question for Jimmy?
Yes, yes. Hi, how are you?
Good,
so it has to do with post-apostolic infallibility. So, you know, like in Matthew 16:19 and Matthew 18:18, there is the binding and loosing, right? So I was thinking if Matthew 23, when it says that the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, kind of validates that this authority of binding and loosing by definition is passed down indefinitely and inherited indefinitely through the generations. Because I think Jesus is validating that for the Old Testament which if we are sensitive to the context, immediate context, that will mean that the binding and loosing for the New Testament was to be also passed down indefinitely. So we should find it in the New Testament, in the liturgies, in some form.
Okay. So I gather that you want my thoughts on that. What I would say is that there is an element of truth here, but we also need to be careful apologetically. One of the things about the Matthew 23 passage where Jesus says that to obey whatever the scribes and so forth say because they sit on Moses' seat is that we don't really know a lot about the institution that he's talking about in his own time. We do have some later references to what it would mean to sit in Moses' seat, and it does seem to indicate a kind of disciplinary authority, which one could get from what Jesus says, you know, do whatever they tell you. But we have to be careful here because we don't know very much at all about how this institution existed in Jesus's own day. And it's easy for Catholic apologists to take later conceptualizations of Moses' seat and try to do things with them and press them back onto Jesus's day when we really don't have the evidence we'd want to support that. Having said that, I do think that the idea of sitting in Moses' seat does convey the idea of something that has been passed down. You know, there's a connection between Jesus' own first century and the people exercising this authority and the time of Moses. So there is the idea of a succession in this passage. And that also, I think, can be used to reinforce the idea. I think it can be reasonably used to reinforce the idea of binding and loosing as discussed in Matthew 16 and Matthew 18 as something that ought to be passed down as well, that there's going to be a succession there. And that's something you don't really need Matthew 23 for because when Jesus gives the authority to bind and loose to first to Peter and then later to the apostles more broadly, it's a legislative authority, and if it's the power to make and abolish laws for the Christian community, and if that function was needed in Jesus's own day, then it's going to be needed in later days too. So I think simple reason alone will tell you that's going to be passed down, but you can reinforce that idea by appealing to Matthew 23 and the successive function of sitting in Moses' seat that had been found in the Jewish community. There's going to be a parallel function in the Christian community. Where I think we need to be especially careful, though, is connecting this to the idea of infallibility. Because what we can show, and this is something you can show, for example, by looking in the Jewish Encyclopedia from 1906 and its discussion, it's online. It's at jewishencyclopedia.org, if I recall correctly. And it has a whole article on binding and loosing. And it documents the meaning of this phrase from other contemporary Jewish sources like Josephus. And it's clear that it did refer to the ability to make and abolish laws for the Jewish community or policies for the Jewish community and to administer justice in the Jewish community, like banning a certain person for misdeeds or things like that. But this is a legislative or judicial authority, and that's not the same thing as a teaching authority, which is what infallibility has to deal with. In fact, the church is infallible in its teachings when it teaches infallibly. It's not infallible in making laws or in policy decisions or administrative decisions. So I think we're cross-connecting two different categories here. And consequently, now you can argue that there is a teaching authority that's resident in the power of the keys, but showing that from the biblical text is another matter. And if we want to be cautious in our application of biblical texts and cautious in our exegesis of biblical texts, we don't want to claim that we can show more than what the text itself would mean in its ordinary environment. And what we can show is that this referred to a legislative authority. We can't show that it referred to a teaching authority. It may include that, but showing it is the problem. And so I wouldn't use any of these texts, whether Matthew 16, Matthew 18, or Matthew 23, as a defense of some kind of church infallibility, because I can't show that that's what these passages would have referred to in their original contexts.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. That brings us to the first break. Hey, right now we've got the Fat February $10 book sale going on. We've got bestsellers for $10. We've got new releases for $10. We've got a bunch of Jimmy Akin books for $10, all over at shop.catholic.com. 100 books, more than 100 books and ebooks on sale right now for $10 each at shop.catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
So I listen to this show as frequently as I possibly can, and I love it.
Just started listening to EWTN a couple months ago, and I pull phrases and words off of the things you say so that I can use them to talk to him. And I wanted to say thank you.
Thank you very much. It really is it's a gift to have this opportunity. And thank you for what you do. I mean, if you two didn't do what you did, then we wouldn't be able to get to express what we do.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Having fun. Jimmy Akin's here. Try to beat that. And, I can beat it. Three lines open right now. That rarely happens when Jimmy's here. If you've got a question, it's an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884. Ricky's in Bellevue, Nebraska, watching on YouTube. We're glad to have you, Ricky. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Ricky. Hey, guys. Thanks. I want to say thank you to you guys. Much kicking and screaming, I've actually decided to re-enter the church.
Aw. Who did the kicking and screaming? Was it you or somebody else?
Me.
Okay. I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad you're back, Ricky.
Kicking and screaming.
All right.
Yeah. Well, so Jimmy, I had my question is more, but Alex O'Connor was on the Jubilee One Atheist versus 20 Theists, something like that. And one of the arguments that he makes in regard... Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, just so you know, you're cutting in and out. So if you can speak directly into the phone and speak concisely, that'll maximize my chance of hearing the question.
Sure. Can you hear me better now?
Go ahead, ask your question.
Okay. My question is, Atheist versus from Alex...
You know what? I'm sorry to do this to you, Ricky. I got to put you on hold for a real quick second. Edgar's going to open the lineup with you and see if we can straighten that out. We're just losing every other word, so I can't make heads or tails of it. And I apologize, Ricky. Let me go to Will in Illinois. I am coming back to you, Ricky. I'm not hanging up on you. Will in Illinois, listening on the Covenant Radio Network. Go ahead, Will, with your question.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I served in the Marine Corps for about 20 years. And there's many people I served with who are struggling with the conflicts that we fought in over the past, you know, two decades. And I was looking for answers of helping with healing. And I visited this church up in Milwaukee called St. Stanislaus. And I learned about this prayer from Father Peter Mary Rookie called the Miracle Prayer. I just wondered if you knew about him, his ministry, or any suggestions for us who served in the military and our families for healing the wounds that many carry.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not familiar with the gentleman you name or the prayer that he wrote, so I can't really comment on that. I hope that, you know, if it looks like a prayer that that has promise, I definitely encourage you to try it and, you know, see it, what kind of benefit it may provide. When it comes to healing in general, the church has a variety of things that it can either do or assist with in that regard. Now, you mentioned wounds left over from battle, and those can take more than one kind of form. There can be physical wounds, for example, and for those, Christ gave us the anointing of the sick as a way of trying to address serious physical issues. So if someone has serious physical wounds as a result of having served in the military, that's something that the church can definitely offer in addition to, you know, conventional medical treatment. Then there are emotional wounds, which are by far the most common. You know, even if someone comes through a war with no physical injuries as a result, or if their physical injuries all heal, there can be spiritual and psychological wounds that continue. Now, one way of addressing those wounds is through, you know, through contemporary psychology. You know, there are counseling programs and things like that. And that's something that is principally done not by ministers of the church, but by psychological professionals. On the other hand, even though ministers of the church are typically not psychological professionals, although some of them are, there's also a kind of counseling that can occur with ministers of the church. So, you know, one could talk to a priest or a deacon and say, I have these struggles that I'm dealing with. And, you know, even if they're not a psychological professional, they can still often give a kind of counseling, you know, at least on an informal basis. And they also can provide moral perspective. They could provide spiritual direction in terms of trying different things and seeing what may help one heal. And they can serve as a, you know, a kind ear, so to speak, to as a kind of listening therapy, to, you know, be heard and be understood by someone as you're processing, you know, the after effects of having served in the military. In addition, they can provide similar services for family members, you know, of those who are of service people who, you know, family members are impacted by these things as well. And they can serve as, you know, givers of advice. You know, if the family is having difficulties, they can often provide a kind of sounding board for how can we work on these problems? What are the resources? What are the options? What should we try? And so forth. Then there is also the sacrament of confession. Now, confession is specifically for things that are of a moral nature, where one may have done things either in the military or in any other context where one feels like one didn't do what one should have, and one needs to find healing in the wake of having done things one shouldn't have. And the sacrament of confession is there for that purpose. And also a good bit of counseling may take place in the sacrament of confession. Then there may, in addition to these, be Catholic support groups for people who have a military background. This would be especially the case if, you know, there's a Catholic military hospital nearby, or any kind of military hospital nearby. There may be a Catholic support group there. There may be support groups in the parish that could connect different former service people to be able to talk about and heal from their experiences. So I'm not sure exactly what options would be available in your area, Will, but those are some of the things that occur to me that would be worth checking out and exploring, depending on the nature of the situation.
Will, thank you very much. I do hope that that was helpful to you. We got Ricky back, so I'm going to go head back to Bill.
Also, Will mentioned about this prayer, and the church certainly has a ministry of prayer that people can be connected with for various needs, including those stemming from a military background.
Thank you, Will. Ricky in Bellevue, Nebraska. Maybe we can hear you now. Let's give it a try. You got a question for Jimmy?
I do. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, I'll try to be as quick as I can. So, Jimmy, recently Alex O'Connor did this YouTube thing, One Atheist versus 20 Christians, or Theists at least, and he said that suffering makes God's existence unlikely. And he stated that because suffering exists, therefore it would seem unlikely that a theistic God exists. My question, though, to you would be, and maybe you can help me out with this, would that not actually work against the naturalistic view? Because would suffering not entail consciousness, which is something we would expect to see on theism, but would be unlikely to see on naturalism? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I would agree. There are multiple responses to this objection, but one response is that suffering requires consciousness. If there something is not conscious, if it's not a conscious entity, then it doesn't suffer. That's not to say it has full level human consciousness, but without consciousness, there is no experience of a subjective nature, and suffering is an experience of a subjective nature, and therefore, in order to have suffering, you have to have consciousness, and consciousness is something you would expect on a theistic model that presupposes there is a consciousness that created the universe. Whereas if one supposes a purely materialistic nature, the idea of consciousness would be less probable. And so I would say that one response to the problem of suffering is that that you would expect consciousness on a theistic model more than you would expect consciousness on a purely materialistic model. In fact, there's even a debate among materialistic philosophers about, does consciousness actually exist, or are we all philosophical zombies?
Holy smokes. All right, Ricky?
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I think consciousness exists.
I think so, too. I use it to think that.
That's what I'm currently doing with it. So I think mm-hmm. that it must exist. All right, Jason in Dallas, Texas is next, watching on YouTube. Welcome, Jason. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, gentlemen. How you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Hope you're staying warm, especially in Southern California.
It's tough here, but I'm trying.
But, I had a somewhat of a harebrained, apologetic question to run by Jimmy, or you, mm-hmm. Si. And that's using pre-Reformation historical arguments in support of various Catholic doctrine and beliefs. And two in particular, I was discussing the Deuterocanon with a Protestant friend recently and said, look, there shouldn't be an issue here because the Orthodox denomination, if you will, also recognizes the importance of the Deuterocanon. So that's one example of a historical argument. Another one is a bit more harebrained, and that was I listened to a debate between a Muslim and a Catholic about the Trinity. And what was interesting is that the Muslim argument or perception of the Trinity, that it was God, Jesus, and Mary. So it almost seems from a historical perspective, that hearsay, if you will, that was the view of the way Mary was regarded by Christians as early as, you know, in the 600s or whenever Islam was founded. So, Jimmy, do you have any thoughts on using those sort of historical comparative arguments in apologetics?
Well, there's certainly utility to appeal into in discussions with Protestants. There's certainly utility to appeal into history before the time of the Reformation and document in various things from that time period. Now, that may or may not that'll have different levels of convincing power for someone coming from a Protestant perspective. And some of them, it may have very little persuasive power because they, in principle, adhere to sola scriptura, or the idea that we should do theology or form our Christian doctrine by scripture alone. And if they're going to interpret that super strictly, then they may just cut out all historical considerations. But not all of them will do that because some of them are more open. But some of them will. So it may not be persuasive to everybody. When it comes to the comparison of different pre-Reformation groups like Catholic and Orthodox and their views on the deuterocanonical books, I think that's a promising line of exploration. When it comes to the Muslim misunderstanding of the Trinity, though, I think it's less promising because this was clearly a case where Muslims simply misunderstood what Christians believe about the Trinity. And although it does show a high regard for Mary, the fact that we're dealing with Muslims and the fact that it's so such a misunderstanding will prove to be too big a distraction for many folks in the Protestant community to give it the weight it deserves. They're going to have a very negative reaction to that claim, and that negative reaction is likely to overcome what force the argument might otherwise have.
Jason, you probably can hear the music, so that means we've got to go to a break. But I'll tell you what, I think a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, would be great for you. And if you'd like it, just hang on. Give us your address and we'll send it off to you. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Why do Catholics pray to dead people, bow to statues, venerate relics? And where do we find any of this stuff in the Bible? In the delightful book, The Saints Pray for You, Dr. Carla Broussard convincingly defends the ancient Christian belief rooted in Scripture that the saints care for us, that they're our allies. Order your copy of The Saints Pray for You today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
On the next More to Life, no go.
When is enough enough? We'll help you set better boundaries.
That's on the next More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest both hours today. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, about the Bible, about Jesus, about whatever you like. Want to talk about the moral life? Want to talk about philosophy? Whatever. If you've got a question, we'd love to get it to Jimmy. Just give us a call, 888-318-7884. As always, you don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. Now we are off to Michael in Buffalo, New York, watching on YouTube. Michael, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about a Protestant friend who's discerning Catholicism. She has difficulty understanding the difference between Catholic and Calvinist baptism, especially when it comes to baptizing babies. One of the difficult things that she has a hard time understanding is that if a baby is baptized, how would they ever know that they were baptized unless somebody tells them? And I was hoping you could clarify a few differences for me.
Okay, well, let's start with that question. Well, if someone baptizes a baby and then they keep it a secret from the baby, then the baby won't have any way of knowing that they were baptized. You know, so there, in fact, are cases of folks who were baptized as babies and then their family quit going to church and they never mentioned, oh, yeah, we had you baptized. So there are people who either discover much later in life that they were baptized or never discover that they were baptized. So that's just a reality of life. What I'm wondering about, though, you said that your friend has trouble differentiating between the idea of Calvinistic baptism and Catholic baptism when it comes to the baptism of infants. Actually, John Calvin and the churches that most of the churches that historically identify as Calvinistic, like Church of Scotland, Reformed churches, and Presbyterian churches, they actually do baptize infants. There's no disagreement on that practice. Where you do have a few churches that otherwise subscribe to Calvinist theology that don't, it's like in Reformed Baptist circles or Reformed non-denominational churches. But when it comes to churches that are fully historically Calvinistic, they actually do baptize babies. So what tradition does your friend belong to?
I don't know the exact tradition. I just know she said she was a Calvinist. But
okay.
I know this is a big thing with her that she says there's just a lot of differences that she doesn't really understand how it washes away your sins if you're not repentant as a baby. And that's mainly her difficulty.
Well, if you're a baby, you don't have personal sins because you're not a free moral agent at that point in your life. You can't make a conscious decision against God. Now, this is going to get into other areas, like it's common in Calvinism, for example, to hold that people are literally held guilty because of what Adam did. So God, would send us to hell, even if we've never done anything bad ourselves. He would send babies to hell because of what Adam did. At least that's a historic view. Now, today, many people, even in Calvinist circles, would find that problematic. But historically, that would be the understanding. And so Calvinists would say, unless you're an elect baby, then you would go to hell. But the idea of sending someone to hell when they didn't do anything personally wrong is unjust, and people have a strong intuition that it's unjust, and that's one reason that it requires special effort on the part of Calvinists to try to convince people to go against their intuition that God would just send people to hell because of something they didn't do. So you've actually got human intuition on your side in that regard. What I would suggest, and what I generally find persuasive in these situations, is not starting by trying to answer the theoretical questions in this area, but instead to show the biblical principles that are involved. Like, for example, if you go to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin, I have a video. It's called something like Infant Baptism, an Overlooked Argument. But if you search my channel for infant baptism, it'll come up. And it kind of sketches the reasons why Christians began adopting infant baptism early on. It was in part because even apart from the issue of forgiven sins, it gets God's grace working in your life. You get new life through baptism, and that's something that that Scripture is really clear on. It says it in multiple places. It says that in Romans. It says that in 1 Peter. It says that a whole bunch of places. And if you're a Christian and you've got a baby, you want God's grace working in their lives as early as possible. And so the natural thing to do for a loving parent would be to baptize your baby unless there were some compelling reason not to. And there are no passages that say don't baptize babies. So given an understanding of what baptism does for a person, the natural thing to do, the loving thing to do, is to get your baby baptized as soon as possible so God can start working in his life as soon as possible and not waiting until some later arbitrary date. So what I would do with her is I'd recommend that video to her, but then there are also a lot of resources we have at Catholic.com that could be a benefit. We have, you know, a tract documenting quotations from the early church fathers showing how this was part of the practice in the early church going all the way back. And we have another tract on infant baptism specifically. And then if she still has concerns after taking a look at the biblical, theological, and patristic evidence, you know, we'd be more than happy to try to answer them. She'd be welcome to call herself, or you're welcome to call and, you know, ask questions on her behalf. Either one of those is fine.
Michael, I'm going to say thanks and leave that there. I hope that that was helpful to you. Lots of folks on the line right now. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's Ask Me Anything. Michael is in Des Moines, Iowa. Michael, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. My question is, when God comes again be his third coming, since Creed says he died and rose again on the third day, so wouldn't when he rose again technically be his second coming? Then why do people say his next coming will be his second?
All right,
okay,
Michael.
So the term second coming is not a biblical term. It's a theological term. And so it's not found in the Bible. It's something that's found in theology. And therefore, its meaning is not determined by the Bible. It's determined by how people use the term second coming. And when they when the term arose, people would think of Jesus's so-called first coming as his entire earthly life. So, you know, from the incarnation all the way through the ascension, that's the first coming. And so that's how people thought about it. It's the first coming is this big complex of events that occurred over a period of 30 years. And he's not on earth in the same way right now. And so, but he will be in the future. You know, he will return and at the end of the world. And so people began speaking of that as his second coming. Now, that's not to deny that there are other comings of Jesus. You know, he, for example, comes in the Eucharist. He also comes spiritually. He comes in judgment on cities like Jerusalem. So there are a variety of different comings that Jesus has, but the way theological language evolved, the second coming was reserved for when he will return in manifest bodily form, like he did over the period of his first coming between, say, 3 BC and AD 33. Now, you could carve out a specific moment in that, at, like when he rises from the dead, as an additional coming, but that's not historically how people thought about it, because they thought of all of his earthly life, including the portion after his resurrection, as the first coming. So they would consider that moment as part of the first coming. You can pull it out and say, well, we could consider this another coming too, but you would be using language in a way that other people don't, and therefore that could lead to confusion. There's nothing wrong with using language in ways other people don't, as long as you avoid confusion. So, yes, technically you could renumber his comings in a different way, but this is the way that's conditional, that's traditional. And if you want to be understood, you want to follow that convention.
Michael, all that makes sense to you?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. and the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary. Designed exclusively for EWTN, the unique centerpiece and crucifix represent the reality that all life is sacred and begins at conception. Help build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary. Available now at EWTNRC.com. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akins, our guest, and both hours. It's Ask Me Anything if you've got a question. We've got one line open for you right now, 888-318-7884. Heading up to Ontario, Canada. Deborah in Ontario, Canada, watching on YouTube. You are next. Go ahead, Deborah, with your question.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in regard to myself. I'm moving to a retirement community, mm-hmm. and I don't have a vehicle. They do have Catholic Mass once a month, mm-hmm. and they have communion visits once a month. Mm-hmm. On Sundays, they do have what they call Sunday service with different chaplains. Is mm-hmm. it okay to go to that?
Well, there's no restriction on going to ecumenical services, so that's not a problem there. Now, it won't fulfill your Sunday obligation. Catholics yeah. have an obligation, except in special circumstances, to attend Mass in a Catholic rite. If you can't attend a Mass, then you want to attend a communion service, a Catholic communion service. And if you can't do that, then you basically, you know, you don't have a Sunday obligation. So if there's no other way for you to get to a church, then I would say, well, you should go to the Catholic Mass at the retirement home. You should go to the Catholic communion service at the retirement home. And you're on other Sundays, you would be free to, you know, watch Mass, Catholic Mass online or on television, and you'd also be free to go to the ecumenical service in the retirement home. That's assuming it's not reasonably practical for you to go to another Catholic Mass. If you're in a town, like it says here, you're in Ontario, and if you're in a, you know, if you're in an area where there are other local Catholic churches, even if you can't drive to them yourself, you might be able to ride share with someone. And, you know, you might be able to contact the closest parish and say, hey, could someone pick me up on these Sundays because I don't have another way to get to Mass. I can't drive myself and so forth. You might even be able to organize a ride share service with other Catholic retirees in the retirement home maybe the retirement home has a bus and they could take a whole group of Catholic retirees to a Catholic Mass at a nearby parish. I don't know if those are possibilities, but I would, if I was moving into a retirement home, there are things I would explore. However, if it's not practical on a given Sunday for you to go to Mass, then you don't have an obligation to go on that Sunday or on those Sundays.
Okay, yeah, that is a good idea, though, in regard to contacting the parish to see if somebody could mm-hmm. pick me up to attend Mass, and also for other retirees, if maybe we got together and did ask if the bus could take us. Those are good options. Yeah, yeah, those are good ideas.
Awesome. Very good.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, where are we going now? Let's go to Joe in Peachtree, Georgia, watching on YouTube.
Question.
Oh, go ahead, Joe.
So my question has to do with the incarnation of Christ. I'm curious if it's possible that Christ could have come in another avatar, for example, maybe being interpreted through a different cultural lens, let's say to India. Is there any kind of truth or related to that question?
Well, you ask, is it possible that this could have happened? And, well, God is omnipotent, so he can do anything that doesn't involve a logical contradiction. And so, yeah, it's possible that he could have come in a different cultural context than besides to the Jewish people. He could have done that whether, now, in our timeline, he did incarnate as a Jewish person. It's possible that in another timeline, God might have chosen to use a different people as his chosen people. And rather than become a Jew, he might have been incarnated into another people. It's also possible that he could incarnate in both the Jewish people and in another people. So those are hypothetical possibilities. Now, if you're asking about what happened in the real world, I would have to say, well, I can't limit God's omnipotence and say God didn't do things. I mean, God does hidden stuff that he doesn't tell us about all the time. But we have no evidence that Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, ever incarnated apart from his incarnation as Jesus of Nazareth. And since we have no evidence that that happened, I wouldn't pursue exploring that, because one could get misled and one would be basically, to my mind, wasting time on possibilities that we have no evidence for.
All right. I'm going to leave that there, too, because we're coming near the end of the hour. Joe, thank you. I hope that was helpful to you. Nate's in North Carolina, while also watching on YouTube. Nate, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Nate. Hey, Jimmy. Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just a note for the listening audience, there's no need to ask, can you hear me? Because if we can't, we'll tell you.
Well, I appreciate that. Hey, thanks for taking the time. Quick question, kind of a, well, maybe not so quick, but we'll see. Philosophical question about the church's teaching on contraception, how it's disordered. My question is, if the church's teaching is true on contraception, would that make other forms of technology that we've advanced in human civilization, would that make it also wrong? Like, it seems, in my head, some logical inconsistencies. Like, why is it okay for us to drive cars? We have legs. We should use that, or get a stent in our heart, or, you know, there's all sorts of things that we use that's not necessarily natural and ordered towards, you know, maybe some greater end. But, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay, so the issue is not naturalness. The issue is, what does the technology do? For example, Psychelet, let's suppose I invented a device that its purpose was to chop off your foot. Okay, so I've got this foot chopper. Would all things being equal, would you say that it would be moral or immoral for me to use my foot chopper to chop off your foot?
So immoral. Come on, leave my foot alone.
Yeah, exactly. Because what I'm doing there is I'm harming your body. I'm harming its normal, its natural function. On the other hand, let's suppose you've got a heart arrhythmia and your heart is not beating in time the way it should. So I propose a different device. I say, instead of chopping off your foot, why don't I install a pacemaker to restore your heart's normal rhythm? Would that be moral or immoral?
I hope it's moral. I want it if I'm having trouble. Yes, that sounds
okay.
Moral.
So yeah, that's the basic difference. It's the issue isn't naturalness versus technology. The issue is, what are you doing with the technology? Are you assisting natural function, as in the case of a pacemaker, or are you destroying natural function, as in the case of a foot chopper, or something that sterilizes you, either temporarily or permanently, and thus interferes with your body's natural function? That's the basic difference.
Now, I'll tell you what, I'll come back to you. I'm anxious to hear whether that makes sense to you or not, Nate.
Let me also address one other thing, because Nate raised a related question about, well, like, what about using cars instead of feet? to go somewhere? Well, I would say in some cases, using your feet rather than a car is the thing you should do. You know, I don't need to go out and check my mail. I don't need to drive my car across the street to my mailbox. I mean, I could, but the cost benefit analysis is it would benefit more for me to just, rather than get out the car and go drive, to just do it myself using my, you know, Mark 1.0 human legs. On the other hand, if I need to get to the hospital, then I think the thing to do would be to probably take a wheeled vehicle because it's going to get me there quicker. And similarly, if I have other engagements that I could use a car for that would, you know, shave time off of an otherwise lengthy trip and get more stuff done and do more good in the world and glorify God more, then using a car is fine in those circumstances. So those are kind of the components to the two questions that Nate asked. When it comes to contraception, it destroys bodily function either temporarily or permanently, as opposed to assist in bodily function. And with things like technologies like automobiles, there's a cost-benefit analysis. Sometimes it's better to use your legs. Sometimes it's better to use a car.
All right, Nate, what do you think?
I mean, so I guess it just matters, like, what it's like, what ultimate end is it ordered toward? Because, I don't know, I just get hung up sometimes, too, where it's like, you know, you hear about couples who are, you know, exploring Catholicism, and then, you know, one person's interested, one person's not, and then it puts a huge strain, you know, on people's relationships. And it's like, well, would the greater good be to just, you know, come together in some way, even if it's not the way that the church teaches? That's where I kind of get hung up, is like, what ordered towards the good? I don't know.
Nate, I'm not sure what you're asking. And we're right down to the end of the show. So tell you what, if you have a follow-up question, by all means, think about how you can express it concisely and call back, and I'll be more than happy to help you out, okay?
I'm sorry. I put Nate on hold because I thought we were going to the next call. So I will say okay for Nate. Nate, thanks. I'm going to get to Rebecca in Mississippi real quick, if we can do that by the top of the hour. Rebecca, go ahead with your question.
Hey, I had a question about an episode called Haunted Dolls that you did. It's an old episode. And
what was it called?
Haunted Dolls.
Oh, okay.
It's about 5 years old. Mm-hmm. But you said that God allowed polygamy. And I wondered, mm-hmm. did he allow it as in it's just fine to do that at that time? Or was it in his permissive will, like all evil things that happen to us or that we do? And I also have a second question, if you have time.
Okay, so in answer to the first question, the church doesn't have a teaching on this. There are passages in the Bible that would suggest that polygamy could have a positive value and even be a reward from God. But on the other hand, there are passages that would indicate that could be taken to indicate that polygamy was always a problem. And so how you weight those passages is going to come down to the individual interpreter, and the church doesn't have an official teaching on that. What it does teach is that polygamy is not for today. But when you look at the Old Testament and the status of polygamy in that, different interpreters are going to have different views. What's your second question?
So I've been watching Doctor Who, and I found your episodes with Dom, and I wondered if you were ever going to do any more of those.
Oh, so if I heard correctly, you said you found my episodes with Dom, and the answer is yes. We do a weekly podcast called Secrets of Doctor Who. It's at the StarQuest Production Network, which is sqpn.com, or if you go to any podcast app and type in Secrets of Doctor Who, we're regularly producing new episodes of that every week.
I'll tell you what, Rebecca, because we have come to the end of the hour, I got to leave it there. But I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. If you'd like it, just hang on the line and you can get it. And anybody that's looking for Jimmy Akin episodes, Mysterious.fm, YouTube, just anywhere you get your podcasts, Jimmy Akin all over the podcasting world. You can find lots of episodes. We have to take a very quick break. We're coming right back, though. So if you're on the line, hang on the line. If you haven't called yet, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Whatever the question is, we'll do our very best to get an answer from Jimmy for you. That'll do it for us for just a few minutes. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.